John Friend.
All right, folks, welcome back to another edition of The Realist Report. This is your host, John Friend. Today is Sunday, February 24th, 2019, and this is a live edition of The Realist Report, broadcast here on EurofolkRadio.com. Of course, my website is TheRealistReport.com, where you will find an extensive archive of The Realist Report podcasts, as well as other radio programs I've participated in. You will also find all of my blog posts and articles, a contact page, my Twitter feed, which is embedded in the right-hand sidebar of the website, and many other useful and important links. I am a regular reporter for American Free Press, America's last real newspaper, and I also contribute to the Barnes Review, the bi-monthly history magazine affiliated with American Free Press. I encourage listeners to subscribe to these fine print publications. Check out AmericanFreePress.net and BarnesReview.org for all of the details. Okay, with that said, let me introduce our special guest this evening. Justin Garcia, a.k.a. Master Chim, is back. Justin is the man behind ThePressureProject.com, an outstanding podcast program and website. Justin, welcome back to the program, sir. How are you this afternoon?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Good, man. Yeah, it's always great talking to you. We've done this a couple times. You've been on my program. I think this will be the third time now. And then I called into one of your programs a while back, and we talked for like an hour. So we've had quite a few conversations, and they've always been very good and very powerful and very frank and straightforward. And I always really appreciate that. I've always been a big fan of your work since I first discovered you guys. And to get started, could you kind of tell our audience a little bit about The Pressure Project, why you got it started, what the mission and purpose of your work really is?
Right. So, number one, yeah, I agree. You and I have had some great conversations, which is why I always accept the invite, and I appreciate it. The Pressure Project started a few years back when I basically just needed a catharsis. I needed a new audience to sort of hear my ranting about what was happening in the Western society and what's happened with masculinity, with the family, with tribal dynamics, with all of the different, you know, sort of just insidious energies that are flowing through society these days, and how it's really undermining the integrity of everything we've ever had to use everything we've ever built, you know. And it's grown since then. I've made a lot of good friends. I've made a lot of good enemies, and sure, it continues. you know how that goes, and you know it continues to be entertaining. I have a good time doing it. And I'm always up for a good conversation.
Yes, absolutely. Now, you guys got started, what, in like 2014, was it? Or sometime around there, I think.
I believe it was the spring of 2014. We're almost on a five-year anniversary.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah, because I remember I started following you guys pretty much right when you got started, and I was always really impressed. And, you know, again, as you said, one of the main themes that you've always talked about is the concept of masculinity, and, you know, kind of empowering men to be better leaders, to be better fathers, to be better husbands, to just be better individuals. So I guess, could you kind of talk about the concept of masculinity and how you would define it?
I would say, well, it starts off with being male, right?
Right.
Let's start off with the controversy right from the beginning. You need
Now that is a what you just said right there is a controversial statement nowadays, because there is no such thing as, you know, biological genders anymore, according to these loony left-wing radicals that have taken over our society.
Right. And, you know, masculinity, aside from being male, it is something that has complemented the female role and dynamic perfectly since the beginning of mankind, and has allowed us to see the successes that we have. I would say in a modern era, the modern applications of traditional masculinity are very much a reflection of what has happened throughout history. We look to put ourselves between our family and harm's way. We look to sacrifice our own time, energy, and resources up to and including our lives to make sure that our women, who are the the vessels by which our species procreates is safe and provided for. There's nothing, you know, I myself am married. I'll be married 15 years in a couple of months. And I have my wife and I have four beautiful children. And there is nothing I wouldn't do to sacrifice for them, to provide for them. And, you know, I allow my wife to do all the wonderful things that she alone can do in terms of mothering, you know, my children and maintaining a home, one that, you know, I enjoy coming back to whenever I'm, you know, coming back from any sort of adventure or work or what have you. And, you know, it's, you know, masculinity is something that's probably above all very functional. I think many of the problems in today's society has come from people not looking at the organically grown functional roles of the sexes and have instead opted to try and reinvent the wheel, going by the very subjective, you know, guide of their own emotions and biases. And I think that, you know, coupled with the power that some of them have gotten, you know, into their hands, we have a lot of the troubles that we have today. I will add too that, you know, when you have a group of elites behind the scenes who are, you know, making decisions, trying to undermine the integrity of every single force that would stand in their way, you know, it all starts to just make sense. You know, when you pull the camera back enough, it's like, well, of course, the people who are in power are going to do whatever they can to stay in power. But the way that plays out is they undermine everything that we value and everything that's brought us to where we are today.
Yes, absolutely. And that's been going on for a very long time. There's been this systematic war on traditional Western civilization, on traditional gender roles. And, now we're at a point where, you know, there's a lot of people that would deny the very, you know, real biological roles that men and women do play in a healthy society. You know, again, getting back to this idea that, you know, gender is like a social construct and, you know, there's no difference between men and women. They're each capable of the same things, which I think you'd probably disagree with. So I guess, what are the real biological roles for men and women to play in a society?
Well, I heard a great quote. I don't know who to attribute it to, but it's not mine. But the quote was, society is a gender construct. And when you look at, you know, from as long as, you know, I guess recorded history, we could probably talk biology prior to that or look at parallels in the animal kingdom today. You know, there's always been the gender, the female, who has given birth to children. And during that process of gestation and birth and then, you know, post-birth, you know, caring for the newborn, there has been a vulnerability that the man has always put himself in charge of, you know, mitigating and eliminating and protecting them from harm. I think in today's society, you know, I'm not going to argue, and I've done quite a bit of research in terms of IQ distribution, not only amongst, you know, racial groups, ethnic groups, but also gender groups. And, you know, I'm not here to argue that men are better than women, that women are somehow inept or unintelligent. Quite the contrary. You know, I think they span the distribution scale just as anybody else does. But when you look at, you know, what temperamental attributes are more masculine as opposed to feminine, we see certain roles in society having a disproportionate representation of certain genders, you know, i.e. the nurse, i.e. the coal miner, you know, the, you know, when we look at, you know, those jobs that have traditionally been filled by men, they tend to be jobs that, you know, require not only a more masculine disposition and temperament, but sometimes a masculine physicality, you know, speaking of military and such. So I think that, you know, the men have always been the ones who physically have put themselves in harm's way. They've always been the ones that have had, and I'm speaking in general terms, obviously, exceptions exist because of distributions. But men have always been the ones who have, you know, been more involved in the sciences and math and all of the things that you see disproportionate representation of men in today. And I think the way to undermine that, if I was on the other side of the battlefield, would be to somehow interpret that as being inequality and oppression and obsolete, you know, caveman type thinking. But I think it's functional first and foremost. I think it has been since the beginning, and it continues to be up until this day.
Yeah, and that very much is the narrative that you hear from, you know, mainstream feminism, this idea that society itself, all throughout history, men have systematically oppressed women. That's why they're not represented, you know, in the sciences or, you know, as major CEOs, et cetera. They've been discriminated against. They've been oppressed. And that's just a totally backwards, incorrect way of looking at the situation, I think.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you want to be looking at every individual or every group of individuals throughout history, if you want to choose the safest demographic, you choose to be a white woman, right? So like that's the way it's been since the beginning. So when you hear women of these days, you know, and I tend to get a little perturbed, we could say, about the complaints of first world, you know, kept women who are looking for their, you know, their adventure of significance. And when they start complaining about oppression and the things that they don't have and the inequalities of being a woman, and, you know, they're doing this from their, you know, free speech protected, you know, country, with the police of said state protecting their ability to do so. And, you know, it's the hypocrisy doesn't end. It's somebody yes. that, you know, it's when you look at these women who sit there and I believe they believe what they're saying, but most of them are miserable because they were told at some point in their lives they shouldn't have children, to sit at home and take care of your children and be the mother of the children, which I consider to be the most important job on the planet. Somehow that is beneath her. Somehow that is derogatory or a negative, you know, a negative application of her potential and abilities. You know, they've bought it, you know, hook, line, and sinker, and we're paying for it, you know, today.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point. That's very well said. You know, it's really incredible. It's very, very evil when you stop and think about it. The mainstream has turned, you know, the traditional role for women to bear children, to raise children, to be mothers. They've turned that into this, you know, oppressive thing when it's really the most beautiful, amazing thing in life, really.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, women, not all women, of course, but these modern feminists, I forget what wave we're on, but these modern feminists have been sold the notion that giving birth to and caring for a newborn baby is somehow a bad thing. It is somehow an insult to want to provide a society that allows women to do that job without interruption. And it's just baffling to me. You know, my wife, a mother of four children, I cannot do what she does. There is no way I could do the job that she does. And my children would be lesser if I were to attempt to do that. And, you know, for my wife to be the type of woman that she is, you know, she would never compare her job now to some sort of a career that's making some corporation money or making some business money at the expense of investing time in her children. And I'm a fortunate man to have a wife like that.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, no, you're right. I think those are a lot of good points that you've raised there. You know, one thing I've noticed over the years really is there seems to be this major divide between men and women. And you know, you see like the alt-right, you've been kind of associated, I guess, with the alt-right. We met at like an alt-right event, the NPI conference. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you know, you see some people in the alt-right and I guess in the broader manosphere type space on the internet, you see women in many cases like demonized, you know what I mean? And so on one side, you got like the feminist crowd that's demonizing men as like the oppressors of women. And then on the other side, you see it. So it's very, very frustrating and it gets very old. Could you comment on this divide between men and women? Because in my view, it's totally unnecessary. I mean, we can talk about these things rationally and, you know, bring up some of these points, but I just don't see the demonization of men or women as being productive or helpful in any way.
Yeah, I mean, anytime, I guess to start a little bit more generally, anytime, you know, somebody is looking to end the discourse, end the conversation, you know, you have to start just understanding what you're dealing with. And when we have this notion going around in a lot of feminist circles that men are the bad guy, that we are the enemy, and you look at the men who they surround themselves with, And these are men that, by and large, I will use the term real men, as in functional men. Real men will look at those men and understand them for what they are. What the kids are calling them are cucks these days. I've never been a fan of
right?
I've never been a fan of that term, but you know, when you look at these men, it's, you know, they're men who don't have an easy time building a strong functional relationship. They don't have the respect of other men who are tasked with masculine, you know, responsibilities. And it just hints that we have to stop being spoken to, guys like you and I, if they are going to continue to gain ground. Because if they were to expose themselves to a logical process, a logical discussion, where they would have to be accountable for their discourse, it wouldn't take long for them to have to acknowledge that what their positions are completely emotionally based. They have an idea of how society should be, and it's based on an idea that exists completely in their minds. It has never been successful in application. It's never been demonstrated successfully in history. It's just what feels right to them, and they're willing to wager the survival of our species on that emotionally designed utopia.
Sure. Yeah. No, it makes sense. Well, I guess, how would you describe what characteristics would you attribute to strong, healthy, masculine men? How would you describe a man that fits those labels?
I would say, first and foremost, he understands what his mission is, right? So I am somebody who has certain responsibilities. I've given certain oaths. I have people that count on me. And I understand that there is a priority in my life where those responsibilities exist. I am not somebody who is going to be swayed by the emotional temptations of the vices that you see so many men suffering from. I am not going to sit here and listen to somebody tell me that providing for my children while my wife stays home is somehow oppressing my woman. I think more generally, I understand what I am trying to do via my wife and my children, raising my children to be strong, making sure that I do whatever's necessary to provide for my home and create the safe environment by which my wife can help me raise my children. So when I look at what I would consider the antithesis of a masculine man, you have the men who shirk that responsibility, who sit here and do not know what it's like to put themselves on the hook, that they are not only bound by individually, but tribally. A masculine man understands how to garner the respect of his fellow members, of his fellow tribal brothers. There are men that I respect who I'm connected to, and what I do sort of passes by them in terms of approval to a certain extent, because I choose to act honorably. Honor, you know, is an in-tribe currency of virtue. So whatever it is that me and my brothers in my tribe or people like me, and I would extend this to compatible cultures, you know, we understand what we consider to be honorable behavior, what we consider to be the currency that is based on virtues that we agree upon, and masculine men embrace this. We understand that there are things that we cannot do that will feel good because they will go against the long game that an honorable man plays. You know, on the opposite end, when we see men, and, you know, one of the big misunderstandings, misconceptions, certainly something that I've been accused of, is that I tout masculinity as being this aggressive, strong, violent, you know, you're the alpha, you dominate other people. And quite the contrary, a man does what needs to be done. And sometimes it's going to be physically defending, you know, my family from violence. Other times, it's picking one of my children up when they're crying to let them feel safe and sort of, you know, rock them back and forth till they fall back asleep. You know, whatever needs to be done as a man, I'm going to do. And that is something that modern men are running from.
Yeah, boy, that is so true. I completely agree with that. I think the main thing that I see is just a total lack of virtue and honor in society, certainly at the political level, like the elite political level. We have virtually no honorable or virtuous leaders anymore. And I think that that has trickled down all throughout society. And it's tragic. You know what I mean? I mean, I think every one of us is flawed to a certain extent, but I do try to live a very honorable and righteous, you know, virtuous lifestyle. But, you know, you just don't see that anymore. That's not promoted. It's not elevated. It's not celebrated the way it once was.
No, I agree. When, you know, I look at all the things that in society nowadays is being held up as virtuous, everything is based on the preservation of self. It's based on the appeasement of the pleasures of society. There is a time where every man on earth had things that were more important to him than his own life. And we've lost that. We've lost a connection to things that transcend the, you know, very basic pleasure, pain, you know, instincts that we have as you know, as humans, as animals. And the more people are reduced to this, the easier they are to control. You know, it's not about, you know, an argument that I tend to have. Or debate I tend to have quite often is, you know, this debate over, you know, whether we should be safe or free, and how they are not the relatable things that a lot of, you know, leftists like to make them. You know, they think that safety is free, and it's quite the contrary. It's usually, you know, finding the compromise that exists between the two that allows us as individuals to pursue, you know, our own destinies. But having the thought, the mindset, the philosophy, the politics that we should somehow prevent people from harming themselves, it is completely a tool that is used by people who are in power to have us give our own autonomy to them under the guise of protection and safety. They know they can't make us freer when we're free. But they could always argue they can make us safer, because it's always a potential threat that they hang over the heads of the low IQ citizens of the country who are all too willing to give their, you know, their freedoms and liberties away.
Right. Well, and they're always, you know, promoting some threat, you know, and promising to keep people safe. When in many cases, if you stop and think about it, it's a totally manufactured, hyped threat anyways to begin with. And, you know, I think your point about our society being very hedonistic and, you know, really that allows us to be controlled by the, you know, elite politicians and whatnot, I think that is so spot on and so you see it all throughout society on a daily basis, or at least I do. You know, it's a very defining feature of our society nowadays, is hedonism. It's prevalent throughout.
And, you know, to in any way, put yourself, you know, in conflict with this, what winds up happening is the narrative is you are, you know, a prejudiced, racist, homophobic, you know, crazy man who's just
conspiracy theorist
shooting up fucking yeah. school. You know, it's so cyclical. You see this play itself out over and over and over again. I remember seeing the article. I'm sure you came into contact with it, where there was a gay bar that was having some sort of a drag night that had a young boy dancing on stage and men, gay men throwing dollar bills at the boy. Did you hear about that when it happened?
Yes, yes. Well, which time? I mean, this seems to be happening more and more, you know, on a weekly, monthly basis in America. It's insane now. Yeah, I know what you're talking about, though.
I could just then refer to that archetypal experience that plays itself yes. out over again. And yeah. when that happens, as soon as you criticize it, or one criticizes it on a large enough stage, the pushback is predictable. You know, you're a homophobe, you are closed-minded, you are, you know, fascist, you are, you know, and it's, you know, it's something that I say unfortunately, because I have four, you know, young children, is something that unfortunately I think is going to end in conflict. And what the scale is, I don't know, but I don't see two sides that are willing to compromise. And I know that I'm on the side of our Constitution. And, you know, my side of the political spectrum, just wants to be left alone. And as Jordan Peterson would say, you know, we have all the guns.
Right. Well, you know what? You brought up a topic that I definitely wanted to get into, and that's race in America. We've talked about race in the past. It's a very, very loaded topic, obviously. Certainly when you're discussing it in, you know, polite society, so to speak, you kind of got to keep your mouth shut if you have pro-white tendencies, or if you're a race realist, or if you deviate in any way from the politically correct narrative about these issues. And you know what's so funny, man? In my experience, it's almost easier to talk about some of these controversial, you know, racial topics with non-whites, which is really, really incredible. I mean, white people have been, generally speaking, I mean, this is certainly not true across the board, obviously, but I think generally speaking, we have been just so put down, so punked in such a big time way that most people can't even really, you know, they don't even realize it. I mean, we have been fed fake history, fake media narratives. And again, we've been under this systematic attack, the systematic critique of our civilization in virtually every single aspect of it.
Yeah,
you know,
I agree.
Go ahead. I said a lot right there. Go ahead.
Yeah. I think that, you know, again, going back to the ability to have a conversation, you know, I've spoken about IQ and race with many individuals, separate individuals in my life, friends and otherwise. And it's very hard to continue that conversation effectively without somebody getting emotional. And it's not me. Right. So it's and just to give everybody a little bit of background about me, you know, I come from mixed heritage. My father was born and raised in Puerto Rico. My mother is a second generation Italian and Irish. I, you know, went and had my DNA tested, and I, you know, remember having a conversation with my father, and it was a joke. He passed away last year, but my father, you know, Green Beret, paratrooper in Vietnam, man's man. And I told him, I said, listen, you know, I'm going to give you to 25%. And he said, what's that? I said, African, if you're over 25%, I got to get rid of you. Right. And that was my joke. So he came in at like 22, and he was like, all right, I told him, all right, you're good. You know, we can hold on to you, you know. But I myself, you know, I've been I've always said the racism daywalker. You know, I can get away with saying stuff that a lot of non-mixed race, you know, white people cannot say. But my whole thing is, you know, I'm going to follow the truth. I'm never going to lie to myself. And I'm also going to associate with the people that I choose to associate with. You know, I am also a heathen. And as a heathen, I am rejected because of my mixed heritage from a lot of people. Which is curious to me is that I also, you know, believe that if you do not have, you know, blood from these lands, you know, you shouldn't be following the customs and traditions and the religions of the people from those lands. I do have European blood, as I said before. So I myself have probably niched down a level of introspection where these things are concerned to a much higher degree than the majority of people who have these conversations. And for me, if you do not understand, you know, again, you know, distribution, statistical distribution and the normal curve, the bell curve, the Gaussian curve, whatever you want to call it, and how IQ is represented for different groups, then it's very hard for you to have a conversation about why programs like affirmative action, the Head Start programs, anything that caters to eliminating the lack of equity in a given representation in society, you know, you don't understand why these things are illogical. You know, my whole thing is in America, the Constitution is the compromise. This is the, you know, the compromise that, you know, everybody here in this country makes to be able to exist in the same space. That's not to say that is everybody's tribe. It's not to say that everybody's identity. I would say at a national level, that is the team that we play for. But to say somehow that, you know, Chinese people shouldn't live in Chinatown, or Chinese people, you know, shouldn't have the ability to live in Chinatown, or Italians shouldn't live in Little Italy, and going on, you know, so on and so forth, is to deny something that we all understand to be factual. Again, these are things that people won't bring up in a conversation because of a lack of intellectual honesty and because of an agenda in everything that they discuss. But, you know, for me, it's, yeah, I identify culturally with the European side of my family, but I also run a school, a martial arts school here in the Bronx. I just had one of my fighters one of my pro MMA fighters win a couple nights ago. And, you know, black, he's half Jamaican. His mother's from Puerto Rico. His father's Jamaican, black for all intents and purposes. And he and I exist together, you know, quite effectively. But that has nothing to do with my identity culturally in terms of my race, my ethnicity, what it is that I want my children to learn and be connected to, you know. And I think there are just sort of growing concentric circles of identity that exist whether we want them to or not. And people are going to want to be around the people that look like them, that act like them. And when you look at the different, you know, ethnic groups in America, you see this played out. I don't know if it was Jared. It might have been Jared Taylor that espoused the cafeteria test. You know, you go to a high school cafeteria and there's the white table, the black table, the Asian table, and you know, I myself was in four high schools and I saw that represented in every single high school I went to, you know. So it's somebody that, you know, or I'm somebody that has been around the block, so to speak, and also have a vested interest in this conversation's outcome. At the end of it, you know, there are going to be white people who want nothing to do with me because of my mixed heritage. And that's fine. They're going to be Hispanic people who are going to have nothing to do with me because of my mixed heritage, and that's fine. But regardless of whether I'm accepted by groups or not, I'm still going to be honest, and I'm still going to tell it like it is. And I'm strong enough, and this is the masculinity part of it, I'm strong enough to make my own way. When you have the conversations today in, like you said, polite society, and I don't often get invited to it to have these conversations anymore, but in polite society, they want to make everybody feel special. They want to make everybody feel like they belong in a college or university level education. And what it gets away from is the function of society. You know, the old phrase used to be, you know, the world needs ditch diggers too. But yeah, they do. And everything between that and the most elite, you know, jobs that, you know, high IQ people would get, all of these roles need to be filled. Now, there are certainly a segment of our population that is almost unemployable. And I think this is the group that we tend to run into a lot of problems with. I think certain racial groups are going to be more, you know, disproportionately represented in that group than others. But regardless, and I don't even need to get into the racial groups themselves, but anybody of a low IQ past a certain point, you know, is going to be an issue. It's going to be an issue when you tell these people they can be whatever they want to be. And if we talk about, you know,
absolutely,
you know, and you know, if we talk about, well, you know, if you look at the people who want to live in white communities, the white people who want to live in white communities, because everybody wants to live in white communities, when the whites who want to live in white communities, when, you know, they're charged with this this accusation of hypocrisy because, well, you know, the normal curve says, you know, you have, you know, retarded people who are white also. It comes down to an observation that I make quite often, which is, well, people will take care of their own retards. They don't want to take care of other people's retards. So if that's the case and we are allowed freedom of association in this country, then it only makes sense that people are going to gravitate toward the individuals that they are most compatible with. And we should not be in any position to stop them, because that's kind of how people are more likely to abide by, again, the compromise of our Constitution. As soon as the state steps in and starts telling people who they have to be with and what they could say and, you know, who they need to work for, who they need to hire, you know, this is where we start to unravel all of the freedoms that the founders of this country originally designed. And before somebody yes. brings up slavery, it's like, yeah, that was really fucked up, but we kind of got rid of it. So, you know, get over it.
Yeah, and white people got rid of it, by
you're
the
welcome.
Way.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, no, yeah, you're saying a lot of good things here. You know, one thing that's just so clear to me, like the state of race relations in America, we're really at a point where it's just simply not okay to be white. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. White people are just demonized and targeted. That is the central paradigm that everything revolves around, is the demonization of white America. And I mean, I think this basic concept could be applied on a broader level. I mean, we see white people just being targeted systematically all throughout the world. I mean, whites are the only people that are not allowed to have their own nations. We're not allowed to have our own, you know, our own states, our own cities, our own neighborhoods. You know, forced multiculturalism and diversity and massive third world immigration are being, you know, promoted and advanced only in white countries, it seems like, anyways. And I think that's what this really all revolves around, is we fundamentally live under an anti-white system in virtually every single aspect.
I agree. And again, you know, to me, it's like, yeah, that's what you do when you want to control the world. You know, Europeans are the architects of Western civilization. Europeans are the ones that have the ethnic cohesion and the autonomy and the self-reliance to exist without the great, you know, eye in the sky telling us what to do and, you know, protecting us from ourselves. Europeans do not need this.
Right.
You know,
right.
We're on our own. We don't need – so which means we're much less likely to take a handout. We're much more likely to fight any removal of freedoms, to stand up for ourselves, to maintain our identity. You know, it's funny. I had – like I said, I had one of my fighters fighting Friday night. And after the fight, my guy won, and I went – you know, I came out of the locker room. I was sitting amongst my students in the bleachers, and a fight was going on behind me. And one of my students who was sitting there – he's an Albanian guy, is screaming at the top of his lungs, supporting what's going on behind me. Now, his teammate is sitting right next to him. So he came, you know, we came to support. And I look back and it's an Albanian guy fighting. And he is acting like this guy is his brother because it's an Albanian. And Albanians is, you know, an example of a group that still very much has this cohesion, this ethnic cohesion. And I asked him, I said, do you know that guy? And he said, no, but he's Albanian. And that's all he needed, you know. And there was a time where this was understood by people and it wasn't looked at as something that was bad, that was negative.
Right.
You know?
Well,
you know,
tribe matters. And I mean, this is a very clear cut case of that. Well, no, you're right. And I think your other point about like the authentic history of whites, of Europeans, I think it's been totally distorted. I mean, if you look at, you know, are an authentic or like a pro-white view of history, we should be seen as the conquerors, the builders, the creators, the inventors, the explorers. I mean, who often, not always, we often did these things in very benevolent and beneficial ways to even non-whites. I mean, I think this idea that, you know, like slavery, for example, that it was this brutal, oppressive system. I just fundamentally disagree with that. And I think there's all sorts of evidence, including testimony from slaves themselves, that prove this. I mean, it was this, you know, I don't want to justify slavery, but it was really sort of a benevolent thing where, in many cases anyways, these people were basically workers. They were working for a big plantation owner that kind of managed everything. They were cared for. It wasn't this brutal, oppressive thing, I guess is my main point. But I think that we should be seen as the creators of civilization and the, you know, we bring order to the world, and yet we're demonized and blamed for oppressing and even genociding, you know, all these other people. It's just so distorted and so truly weaponized against white people. And right. That's something that I feel very, very strongly about. We have got to, I mean, we have got to present this history authentically and not be afraid of it. I mean, this is really what it all boils down to, is we should be seen as the creators of civilization, and there's nothing wrong with that. We should not be ashamed of that.
Right. I agree. A couple of things. First off, I don't think we're going to win the pro-European argument by saying slavery wasn't a big deal.
No, well, I'm not trying to justify it. I'm just saying the way it's presented, as this brutal, oppressive thing. I think it's just not true. It's not factual. Maybe in some cases, you know, it certainly was. But, I mean, you can read, like, the diaries from slaves themselves who were writing about this when slavery was ending. And, well, you know, it's very clear that, you know, they were part of a family. They were part of a broader tribe, really, right. Is what it all was about. I mean, that's the main thing. You know, you think about a plantation, I mean, the way I think of it, it's more like a factory, like a big industrial production. I mean, you know, at the time anyways, you know, where everybody was playing a role, and that's how it should be thought of, in my view, anyways.
You know, and I don't necessarily disagree with that, with those observations. The big thing is now, you know, when you look at the freedoms that the Constitution, the Bill of Rights affords citizens of the U.S., you see the formula, the recipe that has turned this country into the superpower. It continues to still be at this moment. Anything that looks to undermine that should be attacked vehemently by everybody, because it's seeking to undermine the very fabric or the structure, the format of what it is we enjoy in American society. When I look at why people are attacking Europeans, again, it makes sense, because we're the ones that don't need them. We could do for ourselves. When it comes to now going past that and saying, well, what is it that we should be doing? You know, number one, have children. Number two, refuse to compromise. You've known me a long time, and you've seen me, you know, speak in different areas, and I am as consistent as the day is long, you know, and I have no animosity towards people. I will say things that will hurt people's feelings, because I think sometimes their feelings are a little bit too vulnerable. But all that being said, I understand that there are always going to be people that are going to look to sabotage what it is that anybody that has any degree of autonomy can enjoy. And I think we need to understand, we need to look at this as a battle. And with a battle, you make sure that everybody understands the mission. You make sure everybody understands their loyalties. You make sure that people don't react emotionally on the other side, you know. And, you know, I know that, you know, when we look at what happens in politics, in the media, in government, then sure, there are a lot of people who are acting in their own interests. You have a lot of dual citizens with Israel. You have a lot of people who, you know, will say whatever needs to be said. You know, they're the bread and circus parade for all the low IQ voters in the U.S. And it is obviously a skewed representation of what reality is and what history has been up until now. Of course, Europeans were the ones that created all of this. Of course, the Europeans are the ones that put in place, you know, the types of societies that we enjoy, not only in America, but throughout the world, wherever there has been freedom, wherever there has been, you know, any form of, you know, democracy or anything resembling that. You know, well, of course it was the Europeans to do that. But at this point, it's also the Europeans that are resisting giving away those freedoms. When I look at, I remember I did an episode of the Pressure Project a few years ago, and it was called Pure Blood Nonsense. And it was on the heels of getting this sort of scathing email from a listener that accused me of being a fraud, heathen, and you know, and I got called everything in the book, you know, nigger, spick, monkey, and he wasn't even an English speaker, like a native English speaker. So I was kind of actually impressed by how many insults he knew about, you know, racially driven insults. but you know, my whole thing to him was, well, first off, you know, if you want to talk about, you know, a European, you know, mindset, I wear a Mjolnir pendant on my chest. And, you know, my whole thing is, if you don't like it, come and fucking take it, you know, come and take it off of me if you don't want it. And another thing, when you talk about pure blood, well, let's make sure we understand what the value of a pure blood is, because in practice right now, I look at countries like Sweden. Shout out to the Golden One, who's a buddy of mine, who's fighting this tooth and nail. But when you look at what these European countries have allowed to happen in their countries and allowed invaders to take over their societies without any bit of, like, without an army, without weapons, without war, without battle, they have allowed these, they have invited these people into their countries, you know. It's what exactly?
Oh, it's disgraceful. It's shameful. It shows you that we've been psychologically defeated and put down, really.
Right. And absolutely.
That's how we've been conquered.
Right. And I think when we look at, you know, all right, when we look at a European blooded individual, there are things that we're looking to protect. We're looking to protect culture. We're looking to protect history. We're looking to protect even blood, you know. I won't, you know, throw that out, you know, by any means. But all of that also pales in comparison to the mindset that created Western civilization in the first place, which is we are going to stick together and we're going to overcome our adversaries. We're going to overcome any obstacles that put themselves in our way. And you see this, that sentiment completely just eliminated from the mindset of the European man these days. Obviously, there are groups who are still on task, but by and large, the Europeans of 100 years ago compared to now, it is like a different fucking species. You know, and the Americans are not very different.
No, not at all. It's the same thing here in America, maybe even more so. And I mean, think about it. The prevailing narrative of our history is, in my view, fundamentally wrong. You know, this idea that we're a nation of immigrants is just really a Marxist Jewish concept, really.
It's just inaccurate.
Well, you're right. It is. But I mean, it really emanates from radical left-wing Jewish communists. And, you know, really, America should properly be understood as a nation of white Christian explorers and settlers and builders and inventors, again, that built this very incredible nation, perhaps the greatest nation in history. One of the most technologically and, you know, economically advanced countries anyways. I mean, it's really this incredible place. And it's being taken from us, and we're letting it happen. You're absolutely right about that. And that's because of what? Fake news, fake history. You know, people, our leaders losing their virtue and their honor and being total sellouts. That's very, very clear.
You know, when one researches, you know, who founded this country, there are a lot of interesting things about George Washington's life that, you know, that make for, you know, just great story, great lore, great, you know, legend. But one of the great things about George Washington is he could have been the guy. He could have been the king. He could have been the ruler. They talked about, you know, who he was when
they wanted him to. They were asking him. Yeah, exactly.
And he said no. And he said no because that, you know, that type of man at that point in American history just had things that mattered to him. And it transcended individual power and control. You know, they had a belief in an idea. And you know, I think that, you know, there was a fair bit of, you know, altruism in their intent. But when you compare the people of that time to the mindset of Americans today, you know, we are filled and it's increasingly so, filled with just low IQ, low educated, unambitious, you know, pets. You know, we enjoy a surplus of resources in this country that has allowed us as a society to take care of a nation of pets. And these pets get as much of a vote as anybody who owns property, owns a business, is educated, has, you know, has an understanding of what the Constitution is about and the American identity. And, you know, the more we allow these low IQ individuals in, like you look at a place like California, California is overrun. California, you know, it'll never be a red state again, because they've imported, you know, all of these people who have absolutely no connection to, no affinity or empathy even for the American ideals, the American identity. Nobody is looking to assimilate anymore. This is like this is the world's Walmart, where when you show up, you get, you know, $1,000 in coupons. Like, why wouldn't people want to come here? What they came here for 100 years ago was an entirely different situation, you know. But this country was founded by Europeans with a mindset of you know, self-reliance and looking to make their way as individuals in a new, unexplored, dangerous world. And they made the greatest country in the history of mankind. And we're doing nothing but taking it for granted, you know, while we piss it all away. And I think at some point, and you know, all the government people that are listening to this conversation, I'm not saying I'm going to be the catalyst by which this occurs, but I think it's going to end in conflict, because you know, we've had a civil war in this country before. And I would say, you know, the very fabric of our freedoms and our sort of adherence to the Constitution is worth fighting for, you know, and I think right. It's, you know, we're down that road.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I think we've seen, you know, low-level conflict playing out for a very long time. Going back to, well, certainly once Trump stepped foot on the political stage, I mean, think about his rallies back in 2015 into 2016 when he became president. Trump supporters are out there going to rallies and getting violently assaulted and attacked, and the people doing it are getting away with it, you know.
That's right.
No problem. It's been going on for a very long time, I guess is my point. And I think you're right. And, you know, we see it on a regular basis almost. It's incredible. And think about the fake media narratives coming out. I got to ask you, we only got about 10 minutes left. I got to get your take on this whole Jussie Smollett fake, you know, hate crime situation. I'm sure you saw this, right?
Oh, of course. Of course.
This is just, I mean, it's it was laughable from the get-go. I mean, when I first heard about it, I immediately was like, what? There's no way this took place the way this man is describing it. I mean, it was laughable on the face of it from the get-go. And it's since been proven to be a total staged production, like an orchestrated play that this guy created.
Yeah.
I mean, truly, like by the Chicago police, like it's that bad.
He tried to pay the guys with a check.
Yeah, I mean it's ridiculous. But again, I mean this is another example of this fake media narrative targeting white people. Of course. That's just blindly, you know, supported and promoted by the mainstream media. Of course,
you know, here's, you know, when you look at how many things occur in, you know, the 24-hour news cycle, that if the racial groups were reversed, that everybody on the left would lose their shit. You know, it is a daily occurrence, you know, a daily occurrence. My guy, oh man, I can't think of his name right now. White Girl Bleed a Lot. Who am I thinking of? Oh, I can't remember his name. He does great work in terms of the racial violence, you know, the black on white racial violence.
Colin Flaherty.
Yeah. I apologize. I get hit a lot in the head, but Colin has been on my podcast a couple times. Great guy. Not racist at all. Not racist at all. Actually goes against, you know, a lot of the beliefs where I'm, you know, where I'm like, hey, Colin, like, ease up a little bit. Like, those guys aren't that bad, you know, because he's so, you know, he's so adamant about not being looked at as a racist. But he's somebody who has collected and amassed a library of empirical data supporting the double standard of the way violence goes one way, as opposed to the other, and how it's treated, you know, via consequence in this country, you know, not only the media, but legally. And it is laughable these days to somehow think that, you know, whites get away with things that blacks or Hispanics don't. It is completely laughable because the entire media is biased towards protecting any minority group. You know, I get away with a lot because my last name's Garcia, and I play that up as much as I can. But even if there were things that I have said that I honestly believe, if my last name was O'Leary or something to that effect, that I would be crucified for. You know, but people don't know what to do with me. You know, but the truth is the truth. When I look at how, you know, Jussie Smollett, there are people who are now saying, I saw a headline on a blog post that said, we know you made it up, but we still believe you.
Right. You know, I know. That's how delusional. Yeah. Well, it shows you that these people really buy into this anti-white narrative, this anti-white agenda, despite, you know, the obvious facts being presented right in front of them. You know, it's clearly an agenda.
You know, I've always said the irony should never be lost of how difficult it is to explain low IQ to stupid people, you know. And when you have these individuals who want to have these conversations, who seem to think that, you know, whether it's politics or art or philosophy, whatever they think is right has to be right because they think it. And they think that that is a valid perspective and a valid sort of level of credibility, you know, to have in their opinions. It's not based on anything factual. It's not anchored to anything that has any sort of realistic precedent. It's not even logical half the time. But because they feel it, it must be right. And you see this play out over and over again. You know, when I look at these, I grew up, you know, in the Bronx and, you know, not the worst neighborhoods, but certainly not the best ones. And, you know, I can go to my old neighborhood right now and see friends of mine from my childhood who are standing on the corner smoking, you know, weed and drinking, you know, alcohol, talking about, you know, the man's kept them down and, you know, fucking Trump, racist, this and that. And they're fucking losers.
Right.
They're losing. Like, yeah. You're losing because you're a loser. That's why you're running the losing formula. This is why you're losing. And, you know, it's very, very easy to just take people who can't sort of figure it out and have them just project all the accountability on somebody else that they could collectively attack. And the people who are orchestrating the messages are the ones that are leveraging the manpower. You know, they're the ones garnering the votes.
Absolutely.
And changing the laws.
Who are the people organizing the message, though? That's the key question.
Right. And, you know, and I know, you know, you got a thing with the Jews, you know, my hope is,
right.
I will say again, you know, Ashkenazis are a very intelligent group. I think that anybody that is operating, in a way that is prioritizing the, success of another country outside of America, from an American position of power, needs to be dealt with. I think Israel, you know, as the grand example of this, is very, very effective at manipulating and controlling people who have, you know, legislative influence in our country. But we're still hearing about Russians. We have, you know, people who are elected officials in this country that hold dual citizenships with Israel. I think if you are elected to a position in American government, you know, you should have to renounce any dual citizenship. I think anybody that acts in the interests of another country over America, you know, should be brought up on charges. I think there, you know, we have by and large a bunch of people who are embedded in our government who, you know, their loyalties are not to America. And Israel is the country that has the most successful formulas where that is concerned. So I would say that if you are somebody who spouts off things like, you know, we need an ally in the Middle East, or, you know, or when you talk about the hypocrisy of supporting an ethno state like Israel, when not supporting some other sort of application of that in another country, you know, they come back at you with the Holocaust, you know, or the woe is me.
Yes, always. Always, you know, the Holocaust.
And it's just hypocrisy. You know, it's just hypocrisy.
Yeah. Like, well, think about it. Think about it. We're funding Israel, literally giving them billions of dollars every year. They're building walls all over the place. Literal apartheid walls.
Right.
You know, excluding Palestinians. Yet we can't even get a wall on our southern border when there's clearly an invasion taking place. You know what? We only got a couple of minutes. I got to get your take on Trump and what's going on with the current political scene. I mean, I've just been so disappointed with the man. What do you got to say about President Trump and what's been going on lately?
Man, it's you know, I'd say he's doing better than I guess you got to start with. He's doing better than I think Hillary would have done.
sure.
And I got to like cling to that. But, you know, he's
that's the best we got. That's the best
we got. The best we got.
Nowadays.
You know, he's,
yeah,
he's fucking
it's tough.
Up.
It's tough.
He's fucking up. He seems to be starting to mount his 2020 campaign identity. And, you know, I don't think he's done enough in terms of, you know, making good on a lot of his promises to revert to campaign mode so soon. But he's the best we got.
Absolutely.
That's what it is.
Yeah. You know, and it's God. Cause you know what? He still does say some good things, obviously, but he just cannot get anything done. And his State of the Union address was incredibly disappointing. For a number of reasons. One of the main ones is he's up there talking about how he wants to, you know, work with the Democrats to come to an agreement, come to a solution. When the Democrats are trying to get this man arrested, they want to impeach him and throw him and his whole family and all of his supporters in prison. And yet he's up there saying he wants to compromise and work with them. It's like he's just disconnected from what's actually really going on. And he, you know, he's not taking the bold action that he really needs to. That's the key thing, I think.
Yeah, I think a lot of people like the, you know, the applause getting, you know, doggy biscuits of things like America will never be a socialist country, and you know, getting the, you know, the veterans and the wives of slain slain citizens, you know, getting them applause. Like, people like that sort of, you know, reality show soap opera type shit. But when I think when you look at the substance, like, he was voted in to build a wall to eliminate, you know, immigration, illegal immigration, to sort of vet and maybe change the criteria of legal immigration, to sort of stop throwing money away to these other countries that don't need it. You know, like, he was elected to do these things that we didn't expect him to make friends while doing them, but that's what he was elected to do. And he's, you know, he's the best we got, man. I'm trying to find something good to say, but you know the deal.
Yeah, I know. It's true, man. Well, Master Chim, we're just about out of time, man. Thanks a lot for coming on. I really appreciate it. It's always good catching up with you.
Absolutely. I had a great talk, as always. I appreciate the invite.
Yeah, thanks, man. And be sure to check out thepressureproject.com. How often are you guys doing podcasts nowadays?
Every couple of weeks we do one. I, you know, if you go to the Pressure Project YouTube channel, I've been putting up live videos there a little bit more often. And if you go to masterchim.com, you can sign up for my morning email, you know, my free morning email. But I'm busy. Everyone's busy, and you know, the content's never going to stop.
I hear you, man. I hear you. Well, thanks a lot, man. Yeah, we'll have to do this again in the future.
Sounds good, man. I appreciate it, John. Take care.
Okay. Take care, man.